You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Tikkun Magazine, hoping to mend, repair, and transform the world, a coalition of progressive Jews, has been advocating for a peaceful resolution of conflicts in the Middle East, especially between Israel and Palestine, since its inception. Its chair, Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun Magazine, wrote an editorial recently entitled, After Iraq, A Path to Security. Peace Watch spoke with Lerner today and asked him what he thought was required to establish peace and safety for the Iraqi people.
There's no way to achieve safety and security for the Americans without getting out of there and allowing the self-determination of the Iraqi people themselves. And that is a step that is going to require a lot of courage for the United States to get out and to transfer the leadership of this transition to the United Nations or to some other international body that has its highest commitment setting up democratic processes for the Iraqi people.
And so the question really asked about the security of the Iraqi people. I'm assuming that you believe that once the American troops are out, the security for the Iraqi people will increase?
Well, they're certainly not safe as long as the United States has its own policies it's trying to impose there. On the other hand, the Iraqi people face dangers from the previous Ba'ath Party regime and the possibility of civil war. We've managed to destabilize a country that had an extremely repressive regime, but we've replaced it with a chaotic civil war kind of situation in which there's a kind of war of all against all that's very dangerous for the Iraqi people. And so what needs to happen now is to establish as quickly as possible democratic processes for the Iraqi people to make their own choices.
And so the first step would obviously be for the U.S. to leave. What would the second step be?
Well, the second step would be for the United Nations to be given the power to reestablish the civil life in that country, to turn back on the electricity, to turn back on the water, to provide through some international forces a return to some level of law and order, and then the creation of a democratic process. I imagine that would be calling together representatives of all the different sectors of the Iraqi people and trying to get them to agree on an electoral form that would allow the Iraqi people to elect their own government.
Is that realistic, in your opinion?
Well, it's not realistic as long as the United States has its determination to show its power in that part of the world and then move on to try to intimidate Iran and other countries in the region.
Rabbi Lerner, you're holding a conference in Washington, D.C. starting Sunday, June 1st. Through the fourth. One of the workshops is entitled Healing the World After the Iraq War. The title seems to imply that the world has somehow been wounded by the invasion of Iraq. What do you perceive as the injuries the world has received as a result of this conflict, and what solutions do you propose for healing those wounds?
Well, the first and most important injury that the world has received through the Iraq War is that there has been a validation for the most militaristic elements in the world of the notion that might makes right, and corresponding to that, the sense that if they have advanced enough technologies, they can quickly win their way with any country in the world. And this is likely to increase the level of militarism in every country that has military capacities, give great strength to the sides of the political forces in each country that has military capacity of those militarists who are saying, look, the United States did it, we can get away with this too. If we need to achieve our ends, the best way to do it is through military means. And conversely, it has undermined the self-confidence of many of those who were against the war, and of many people who believe that there were other paths. So part of the problem there is that where there were many people who were against the war, there were very few who articulated a full alternative vision of a way to achieve a decent democratic society for Iraq or for the rest of the world. So what the number one wound here is a validation of power over cooperation. And our conference on Sunday afternoon to Wednesday morning is meant to bring together people who want a different paradigm, a paradigm that says that the way to achieve peace in the world and security for the people of the United States is through cooperation and through an ethos of caring for others, not of domination of others.
And so those are the wounds, and I'm assuming that it's your suggestion that to heal those wounds would be to provide some sort of alternative to what you call the validation for militarism?
Yes. In fact, we're proposing a global Marshall Plan.
Weren't those alternatives there already, though, Rabbi Michael Lerner, and they were just simply ignored and run roughshod over by the U.S.?
Well, you know, when I went to anti-war demonstrations from September through April, and I rarely heard a speaker talking about what would have been the way to achieve a transformation in the world that would promote democratic values and human rights values. What I heard was a tremendous amount of denunciation of regimes that were considered to be violating of human rights, but I very rarely heard a clear alternative vision. We're talking at this conference, amongst other things, about a global Marshall Plan, and a global Marshall Plan that would be implemented at two levels. Number one, we're calling for the United States to set as its goal that 10% of the gross national product of the United States be allocated towards the building of the infrastructure of third world countries and the elimination of poverty, homelessness, and hunger around the world. Now, this is not a goal that has been clearly articulated as what the anti-war movement stands for, and so this is part of an alternative vision. But the second part of that vision is that we also are calling for every American to spend at least 2 years of his or her life involved in active personal work in a third world country to help in rebuilding that country and strengthening its helping to provide training, to provide support, to do it in a way that's ecologically sensitive and respectful of the indigenous peoples of the area, but nevertheless to bring those skills that we may have to that would be useful for people in those countries.
With all due respect, Rabbi Lerner, is that realistic to expect that every American is even going to be inclined to do that and then would have the wherewithal to do that?
No, I mean, if this would be part of the resources that we're talking about, 10% of American resources of the gross national product being directed in this way. We're talking, this obviously is a process that would go on over the course of the next 10 to 20 years to create this in a serious way. But creating this in a serious way would mean that those 2 years that people took of service would have to be compensated for by the federal government and our tax structure. Of course, you know that we're in the process of giving $1.5 trillion back to the richest people in the country. That little pot is the first step in the down payment in the direction of what I'm talking about if we were to take that money back and use it in a different direction. You see, the point is that liberal and progressives in the public sphere, including many Democratic congresspeople, focus a great deal on how bad it is to be giving all that money to the rich people, but they don't have a coherent alternative vision of how the world could be changed in a positive way, where that money could actually be used to transform the fundamentals of our world situation. From liberals and progressives, you often get very narrow visions of, oh, well, we want to use a tiny little bit of money for this and a little bit more money for that and a little bit more money for that. We're putting forward a whole different worldview. Now, if you say, yes, it's unrealistic, of course it's unrealistic. The realists brought us the war in Iraq. The realists brought us the war in Vietnam. Of course it's unrealistic when realism is defined as that which is. But the only way we're going to get from that which is to that which ought to be is by having a coherent and intellectually coherent and morally coherent alternative worldview about how to use the resources of the United States in a way that would actually be in our interests. And I say in our interest because what I'm talking about is the most effective way to combat terrorism, and it's the most effective way to provide security for the American people. Mm-hmm. Billions of dollars going into a military, let hundreds of billions of dollars go into rebuilding the infrastructure of the world and providing funds for people to take off time to provide service for the world. So we're talking about...
I agree with you to a large degree, Rabbi Lerner, with regard to the fact that there needs to be created an alternate vision. I don't know when the last time was anybody had to, for example, have a bake sale in order to try and pay for one of these B-52 bombers or something, right. As people have to do
right,
to
exactly.
raise money for the schools and education in this country. And I borrow that line from my friend Phyllis Bennis.
Yes,
but I initially felt like an alternative to the validation of militarism might be the United Nations, for example, which was completely ignored. That whole process was ignored throughout this ordeal and the U.S. and British invasion of Iraq.
You're absolutely right. The problem with the United Nations and why it needs a fundamental reconstruction, however, is this. The United Nations does not represent the peoples of the countries that it has on the General Assembly or in the Security Council. It represents, rather, the ruling elites of those countries. And very often, the ruling elites of those countries find more in common with the ruling elites of the United States than they find with their own people. So that doesn't mean that we should throw away the United Nations. I think the United Nations needs to be reconstructed with a different kind of vision, a vision in which it is asked not to be the representative of deal makers, but the representative of the best interests of the peoples of those countries involved. Mm-hmm. And that would take a reconstruction of the United Nations, perhaps along lines like those that exist in the United States, in which the House of Representatives is, you know, democratically elected. And it would be great to have a democratic election of all the peoples of the world in a representative body that could then be the new United Nations. Until that happens, mm-hmm. the United Nations continues to actually discredit itself because it often takes stands which are not in the interests of the people it represents, but in the interests of a global elite. And that doesn't mm-hmm. that then makes it hard to generate the excitement on the part of people in the United States or any place else. So we need to talk simultaneously about a vision of the United Nations that would actually represent the highest aspirations of the peoples of the world.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine and author of Healing Israel-Palestine, A Path to Peace and Reconciliation, and co-chair of the Tikkun Conference and Teach-In to Congress to be held in Washington, D.C., June 1st through June 4th. Next Monday, June 2nd, the Federal Communication Commission, led by Chairman Michael Powell, the son of Secretary of State Colin Powell, will likely vote to ease media ownership caps in the U.S. The regulations in place limit the number of television stations a network may own or whether a company can own a newspaper and a television station in the same city. Critics of the FCC's proposal to change the rules predict that the changes will be swift and dramatic, permanently altering the media landscape across the country and further decreasing Americans' access to a diverse range of views and opinions, essential to the existence of a healthy democracy. The two FCC commissioners opposed to changing the rules are Democrats. Those favoring it are Republicans. Perhaps at no time is an independent and diverse media more important than when the country is at war. Today on Peace Watch, we'll hear from one of the dissident Democratic FCC commissioners, Jonathan Edelstein. He spoke recently with Stephen Rohde as part of Pacifica's continuing series, A Clear and Present Danger, which explores the challenges of free expression in an open society.
Commissioner Edelstein, thank you for joining us. Could you please focus our audience's attention on the significance of the June 2nd proceedings before the FCC? I gather they deal with both the question of how many radio stations or television stations can be owned by a single owner, and also the question of whether TV and radio stations can own local newspapers. Are both of those issues before the FCC?
That's right, Steve. I think we're on the eve of the most sweeping and potentially destructive overhaul of the FCC's media rules in the history of American broadcasting. We're looking at all those issues and even some more, whether networks can purchase each other. These are rules that a lot of people don't know about, but they've shaped the American media landscape as we know it. And if we lift or relax those rules, it's going to reshape the American media landscape in ways that I think cause a lot of concern to people.
Now, there were earlier issues regarding the deregulation of media ownership as a result of the Telecommunications Act of 1996. Is that correct?
That's right. In 1996, Congress relaxed the rules governing radio ownership and lifted the cap on how many radio stations a single company can own nationwide. For example, Clear Channel, which only had 40 stations at the time, now has over 1,200 stations, many of them concentrated in the biggest markets in the country. So you've seen a real wave of consolidation in the radio industry. Billions of dollars of radio stations changed hands, and small mom-and-pop stations went out of business in favor of these big national conglomerates that pump in homogenized playlists from headquarters somewhere out of town. And people are really finding that the radio dials lost a lot of the news they used to love so much about the radio, a lot of the local flavor, and certainly they're not getting their local artists played on the stations any longer.
You were instrumental in convening a variety of public hearings around the country, public forums, where average people and others could come in and talk to you as commissioners to give you public input. At one of those recent hearings, I read that you said the experience after 1996 was like the canary in the coal mine. What did you mean by that?
The radio experience is like the canary in the coal mine, where the miners used to send the canary down to see if it was safe to enter before they would go in. We better look at what happened in radio real carefully before we allow consolidation in other media outlets like television and cable and newspapers, because we may see the same thing happen to all of those outlets that we saw happen to radio. More consolidation, more crassness, more homogenization, less serious news coverage. That's what we're faced with.
The question of combining newspaper ownership with television and radio stations in the same market. Aren't newspapers good at finding the news, getting good reporters? Wouldn't consolidation benefit from that kind of combination?
Well, the one area where there's at least a decent argument for allowing some consolidation is with newspapers and television stations, because newspapers do gather a lot of valuable news, and they could actually add some heft to the news coverage on television stations. Some television stations don't have much of a news gathering capability of their own. But that's got to be offset with the concern and the fear that you're losing one voice in the community. So all of a sudden, instead of having just a powerful newspaper, which has a huge impact on the community, that same voice, the same owner, will be able to impact also one of the television stations and will be able to possibly have a disproportionate power over what people in that community hear and see and read about in terms of what's happening in the local community. And the FCC has always tried to maintain a diversity of voices so we can have a uninhibited marketplace of ideas.
Can you give our listeners some snapshot of the nature of media ownership in the television industry today? How concentrated is it?
It's already quite concentrated in terms of what people see, hear, and read. I mean, people often quote about the fact that there's hundreds of stations on television, but in fact, a lot of those stations, the vast majority of them, are owned by about six major national corporations in this country. So while we say that we want to hear more voices in this country, we don't want to hear them from just one ventriloquist. And that's why we're concerned about further consolidation.
What are the forces arrayed in favor of these lifts on the caps and the allowance for cross-ownership? What forces are you hearing from in favor of that?
Well, the loudest voices in favor of that are the very companies that most want to merge. These companies seek to get bigger. And naturally, these companies will want to get the efficiencies that come with consolidating, with getting rid of an extra news department or getting rid of a whole back office staff and allowing a smaller number of people to run two outlets rather than just one. But the job of the FCC isn't to allow for those efficiencies. It's to watch out for the public interest. But, you know, the other group that's calling us are the investment bankers, who are very excited to get a piece of the action. When these deals are cut, the investment bankers will get a part of it. We're hearing from the courts, who are pushing us, particularly the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, to allow further deregulation of the media.
Well, deregulation is a two-edged sword. I mean, I think we all want government out of the business of dictating editorial content. But the kind of regulation we're talking about today is meant to increase the diversity of voices. Isn't that one of your points?
That's right. I don't think that we need the government in the business of telling media outlets what to report on or what to say or what viewpoint they should take. We've traditionally tried to avoid that, and the way we try to control it is by making sure there's a diversity of viewpoints. If there's a number of different outlets, even if some of them have a slant or one slant or another, be it to the right or to the left, they'll basically be able to argue it out in a democratic society where the free exchange of ideas is the lifeblood of a democracy. But what happens is you choke off that lifeblood if you allow one or two owners to control too many of these outlets and to exercise disproportionate power over what people in a community might hear about through their media.
Have you and the staff at the FCC studied the impact of monopolization or oligopolization, if you will, of media in terms of the diversity of viewpoints on the recent war in Iraq or other important public policy issues?
I don't think we've studied it nearly enough. I mean, we haven't looked at that. We haven't looked at a lot of different problems that crop up. I mean, just today I heard from a wonderful children's group called Children Now, who did a report on duopolies, which is when one television station buys another. In 1998, we allowed that to happen in some communities, including Los Angeles. This study found, alarmingly, that between 1998 and 2003, the number of hours each week devoted to children's programming in L.A. decreased by more than 50%. Now, we just found this out today. Why isn't the FCC finding these things out? I mean, I work here, and I'm dismayed that we're having to find out about these things at last hour from outside groups before this decision is made. I don't think we've done nearly enough studying about what the impact of this kind of concentration is on children, on the diversity of viewpoints, on minorities. There's a lot of questions that are left hanging, and yet June 2nd is only a few days away, and we're about to make these sweeping decisions without having really a full idea of what their impact is going to be on the American people.
Now, recently, you and Commissioner Copps specifically asked for a delay in the June 2nd hearing. It was my understanding that generally when several commissioners ask for the postponement of an important vote of that kind and have a reason for that request, that those requests are generally granted. But in this case, Chairman Michael Powell denied your request. Why was that?
Well, we were very disappointed by that. We really thought it was appropriate to get more time and more ability for the public to comment on this proposal. But the chairman denied that request, which you're right, is traditionally granted to commissioners if they ask for it. I guess this is just such a politically charged issue that they want to get it done quickly. But I think it's better to get it done right than to get it done quickly.
What were you hoping to achieve if more time had been devoted to this important issue?
Well, I think we do need to study those issues like those you raised about what happens with consolidation, what are the effects on these different groups that are so important. The proposal changes six different rules, and they interact with one another. If you change the number of TV stations an individual owner can control, how does that impact what cable systems can own and whether or not a newspaper and a television station are bought in the same community? For example, here in Washington, D.C., you can see the major cable company buy the newspaper here in town, the Washington Post, and they could buy a number of television stations. And what impact would that have on the nation's capital, which has such an important role in shaping the views of the people that help make decisions for the whole country? Let's think through what some of the synergies are and some of the effects of this proposal in a broader sense before we rush to judgment on it.
On May 15th, Commissioner Powell, who is the son of Colin Powell, denied your request to delay the hearings. I was a little startled. He said in his public statement, media ownership rules are intended to protect and advance the cherished values of diversity, localism, and competition. Well, I thought that was the whole point you were making by wanting further debate and exploration on this issue.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, hopefully he shares our goals in this. You can see and judge for yourself when this proposal is finally made public on June 2nd. I don't think the direction we're going in furthers diversity and localism. I think it goes in just the opposite direction. But, you know, it's always good to hear that the chairman shares those goals that have historically been what the FCC has been all about in terms of broadcast regulation. And maybe we can yet turn him around and get him to see our point of view that allowing further consolidation will actually undercut local coverage, will actually undercut the diversity of voices that people hear.
What exactly will happen on June 2nd?
June 2nd is when the FCC will vote on the proposals that are now before us. Of course, the proposals that are before us now cannot be made public. And so You haven't seen them. There's been a lot of reports in the press about what they might or might not be. But finally, on June 2nd, we're going to issue a broad outline of what the rules are, and each of us is going to have the opportunity to vote, each of the five of us. There's three Republicans and two Democrats. And if they can get three out of five, then their view prevails. So that will be a historic day and a turning point, I think, in the history of the American broadcast industry.
And that means if there's, say, a 3-2 vote, those proposals, which nobody has actually seen up until now, will actually become new FCC policy.
That's exactly right. And, of course, they could be challenged in court, and Congress can always overturn them. But that is going to be the rules of the country that these companies are going to go by. And I think you're going to see, starting June 3rd, a gold rush by these companies to try to combine and buy each other, and a real massive wave of consolidation will take place, either quickly or certainly over a fairly short period of time.
There are moves in Congress to try to get a hold of this. Some legislation has been offered to preempt the FCC. Can you describe that for us?
Some members of Congress have proposed maintaining a cap on the number of television stations a single company such as a network can own to 35%. Of the nation's audience. Number 150 members of Congress, on a bipartisan basis, have asked us to withhold this vote on June 2nd and come up with a public comment period to discuss this further with members of Congress. You know, it's very tough for Congress to act on something like this because there's powerful forces on the other side, too. A number of members of Congress have urged us to move quickly and get this done and get it over with and allow the big media companies to get bigger. So, you know, we hear from both sides, and it's tough when Congress is so divided for any legislation to get through.
We call our program, Commissioner, Clear and Present Danger. What do you consider to be the most clear and present danger to freedom of expression in the United States today?
Well, right now, I think June 2nd is the most clear and present danger, which is the FCC throwing out 70 years of broadcast regulation and allowing giant media companies to get even bigger and solidify their hold over the American people even more than they currently have. I think we're on the verge of creating a Citizen Kane for the 21st century, or maybe a small handful of them. That's a huge danger to our democracy, and I'm glad that you're taking the time to air this.
With the time that remains between now and June 2nd, is there still something a citizen could do if they feared for the future of diversity in the media?
Oh, there's always more they can do. I mean, they can weigh in on the FCC's website. There's a place where they can weigh in and let the FCC know what their views are. Let their local media outlets know, not just Pacifica, but let all of their local media and their national media to pay attention to this issue, even if it doesn't suit their owner's bottom line. And most importantly, people need to express their views on either side to those who represent them in Congress.
Well, I've been speaking with Commissioner Adelstein, Commissioner of the FCC. Commissioner, could you give us the FCC website?
Yeah, that is www.fcc.gov.
Thank you, Commissioner Adelstein, for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Democratic FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein spoke with Stephen Rohde as part of Peace Watch's continuing series, Clear and Present Danger, which explores the challenges of free expression in an open society. The series is a co-production of PEN USA and the Pacifica Radio Archives. The executive producer is Deborah Jones. The producer is Eileen Moskowitz. And the editor is Mark Torres. To obtain a copy, you can go to www.pacificaarchives.org. And to find out more about PIN USA, you can go to www.pinusa.org. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So please pledge your support through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.